Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the third of this term's lectures by the Cold War Studies Center on America as another country. My name is Arne Westad. I'm one of the directors of the center, and I will be the chair tonight. The idea of an American century is a very powerful idea. It came out of the period of American expansion that started after the Civil War, we heard about 2 weeks ago from David Blight. It really formed itself in the American conscience, I think, very much in the early part of the 20th century. By 1945, by the end of the Second World War, many people in many places in the world, outside the United States, were convinced that they were living in an American century, a century that was turning increasingly in the direction of the United States, not just in terms of the United States' power internationally, but also the United States as a model, the United States as a symbol of what the rest of the world would and could become. This was popularized, of course, by Henry Luce, who today's speaker is writing a biography of at present. By the early 2000s, some people were talking about a new American century, or at least they did so until the difficulties that at present are facing U.S. foreign policy on a global scale. We're extremely fortunate tonight to have with us Professor Alan Brinkley to discuss these matters in light both of the past and I hope also at least in discussion with regard to the present. Alan is University Provost and Alan Nevins Professor of History at Columbia. He got his PhD from Harvard, and he's worked mostly in the area of 20th century American history. The first book I think I read of Alan's came out in 1982, called Voices of Protest, on alternative voices, if you could say so, in the 1930s. Won the National Book Award the following year. He's also published On the End of Reform, New Neoliberalism in Recession and War, which is his 1995 book, and Liberalism and its Discontents from 1998. So a long and very impressive scholarly record joined with his long stints of service at Columbia University. Now, many of the people I've spoken to at LSE, and we have a fair number of Columbia graduates at this place, this is not what Alan is most known for. When I've asked the students who come my way, who've been Columbia undergraduates dealing with history in one of its many different incarnations, who the most popular professor was that ever taught them, the one that almost always comes out on top is Alan Brinkley. So, if you are unable to make an impression on us tonight, which I very much doubt, you certainly have made a very strong impression on the students that you have taught over the years. It's a great pleasure to have you here, Alan, and we're very much looking forward to your lecture.
Well, thank you for that daunting introduction, and thank you all for coming. I know that many people around the world have watched, as have many people in the United States, with some astonishment and alarm at the character of America's performance in the world over the last 4 to 5 years. I'm not here tonight, at least in the formal part of my lecture, although I'm certainly happy to answer questions about the contemporary situation later if anyone wishes. I'm not here tonight to talk about the present condition of the United States, but to try to suggest some of the historical origins of the circumstances in which we now find ourselves. The Bush administration, of course, has a particular quality that makes it different from many other presidencies in American history. But not everything about the way America is behaving in the world today is simply a result of this particular presidency. It has its roots in a long history, as Professor Westad suggested, and a part of that history is what I want to discuss tonight. The phrase American century, which is the subject of my talk this evening, has usually been used to describe a particular period in the history of the United States, and that is the emergence of the nation as the world's greatest power during and after World War II, and also, of course, its crusading internationalism during the Cold War. But what I want to describe this evening is the origins and some of the implications of this idea, both in the longer history of the United States and in particular in the immediate aftermath of World War II. In our own world, the world of the 21st century, a world now defined in part by the events of September 2001 and by the great wave of nationalism and xenophobia that swept the United States in its aftermath, and by the newly aggressive wave of the newly aggressive role in the world that the United States has assumed in our time, the concept of an American century suddenly seems alive again. In many ways, the idea of an American century, although not the term, not the phrase, is as old as and indeed older than the nation itself. And it is in the early origins of this idea that some part of our modern understanding of the concept can be found. Ever since the first Europeans cast their eyes on the New World, the idea that America could somehow transcend and redeem the old world became an article of faith among many people on both sides of the Atlantic. The European settlements in America were destined to be, according to John Winthrop, a city on a hill. According to Abraham Lincoln, the last best hope of man on earth. Or, as Herman Melville wrote in the mid-19th century, we are the pioneers of the world. The political Messiah has come. He has come in us. These 17th and 18th and 19th century proselytizers of American exceptionalism and of the special role America was destined to play in history saw the New World and the new nation as an example, as a model, as a light shining out to a wretched globe and inspiring it to lift itself up. It was a morally energized vision, but it was also a largely passive vision. Few people in those years supported active efforts to impose the American vision on other societies or even to promote it abroad with any real fervor. It was a vision of the United States looking out across a decadent or uncivilized globe, vaguely disapprovingly, hoping that other nations would choose to follow the American example and improve. Another different vision of America's role in the life of the world emerged late in the 19th century when a new and more muscular form of nationalism began to penetrate American thinking about the country's place in the international order. This new vision was inspired by, and was not at times very different from, the European imperial visions of the same time. As Henry Watterson, the editor of a newspaper in Louisville, Kentucky, suggested when he wrote around the time of the Spanish-American War and the American acquisition of the Philippines and other colonies, in which he wrote, "From a nation of shopkeepers, we become a nation of warriors. We escape the menace and peril of socialism and agrarianism, as England has escaped them, by a policy of colonization and conquest. From a provincial huddle of petty sovereignties held together by a rope of sand," this is a reference to the 13 colonies, which were known in the 18th century as a rope of sand in America. "From a provincial huddle of petty sovereignties held together by a rope of sand, we rise to the dignity and prowess of an imperial republic incomparably greater than Rome." This was a somewhat exaggerated vision of American power in 1898, but nevertheless an example of at least one kind of thinking about America's future that emerged after that conflict. Theodore Roosevelt similarly told a California audience 5 years later in 1903 that The great expanding nations of history leave behind indelibly their impress on the centuries. I ask that this people rise to the level of the greatness of its opportunities. I don't ask that it seek the easiest path. But the more powerful, or at least the more accurate expression of this new sense of America's new global role was not a conventionally imperialist one of the kind that Watterson and to some degree Roosevelt expressed. It was better expressed by, among others, Henry Cabot Lodge, the Massachusetts senator and chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who became the most powerful obstacle to Woodrow Wilson's dream of a new world order after World War I. Lodge saw no contradiction between his fervent opposition to the League of Nations and the Treaty of Versailles and his equally fervent commitment to the idea of America as a great global power. But he did place boundaries around that idea. He said during the debate over the League of Nations in 1919, "We are a great moral asset of Christian civilization. How did we get there? By our own efforts. Nobody led us, nobody guided us, nobody controlled us. I would keep America as she has been, not isolated, not prevent her from joining other nations for great purposes, but I wish her to be master of her own fate." The cluster of ideas that these statements, and Lodge's in particular, represent marked, I believe, an important departure in America's relationship to the world, but also a sharply bounded one. America would take its place among the great world powers, these early champions of empire insisted, but it would not tie its fortunes to those of any other nation. It would make no alliances. It would acquire no colonies other than the ones it somewhat hesitantly absorbed after the Spanish-American War. The United States, unlike European colonial powers, would not seek new opportunities to remake other societies in the Western image. It would rather act unilaterally to promote its interests and to preserve an open door for American trade. The vision of an American century that emerged during and after World War II was, in some ways, a fusion of these two related, but until the 1940s, separate visions. The vision of America as a model on the one hand, and the vision of America as a great power with international interests on the other. The critical ingredient that now set the United States on its new path, which was born of the nation's experience in World War II, was the determination of many Americans to use the nation's great power actively and often very aggressively to spread the American model to other nations. At times through relatively benign encouragement, at other times through pressure and coercion, but almost always with a fervent and active intent. Many prominent Americans worked to promote this new and more expansive vision of America's global destiny, which for a time in the 1940s had relatively thin popular support. But the man whose name is most clearly linked to the idea of an American century is undoubtedly Henry R. Luce, the founder and the crusading editor and publisher of Time, Fortune, and Life magazines, and as early as 1940, one of the nation's most outspoken internationalists. Luce believed strongly that the United States must assist Britain and its allies in their war against Germany. And earlier than most supporters of Britain, he believed that eventually America must itself become a combatant in the war. In 1940, he joined a group of influential internationalists to put pressure on the Roosevelt administration to find new ways to help the imperiled British war effort, known as the Century Group, after the elite New York Men's Club in which they held their meetings. They played an important role in persuading President Roosevelt to create the Lend-Lease Program in March 1941. A few weeks before that, on February 17, 1941, Luce produced a celebrated and controversial essay which was published in Life magazine and later as a book entitled The American Century. And that title, although not original to Luce, he helped make a part of the nation's and the world's public language. Luce's vision of an American century was rooted in part in his own particular experiences. He was born and spent his entire childhood in China. He was the son of a Presbyterian minister and missionary who taught in a small college for Chinese converts to Christianity. Luce's first sustained experience with America came when he entered prep school in Connecticut in 1913, when he was 15 years old. In China, Luce lived with his family inside walled missionary compounds, where he encountered virtually no Chinese people except for domestic servants, and instead spent his youth almost entirely in the company of like-minded missionary families from America and England. Outside the compounds were the fetid villages and the ravaged countryside of a desperately poor region of China, Shandong. Inside were the pleasant houses, the carefully tended gardens, the stable communities of the Victorian Anglo-American bourgeois world. And the contrast between the ordered Victorian world of the missionary compound and the harsh social realities and physical landscape outside the compound reinforced the assumptions that drove the Protestant missionary project in China. An unquestioned belief, of course, in the moral superiority of Christianity, but also in the cultural superiority of American and Western culture. A commitment to showing the way not just to the love of Christ, but to a modern scientific social order based on the Western and particularly the American model. Luce, as a child, knew almost nothing about America other than the idealized image of it that his father and other missionaries created to justify their own work. America, to him, began not as a physical place, not as the diverse and contentious culture that America actually was and is, but as an abstraction, as an ideal, and as a model. And even though he spent over half a century living in the United States after 1913, he never really abandoned his youthful attachment to a carefully constructed myth about America's history and its place in the world. Decades later, the American century's ebullient, moralistic, and paternalistic language echoed in many ways the missionary creed that Luce and many other missionary children, who also went on to play influential roles in America's late 20th century global missions, must have heard every day as a child. But Luce's American Century essay was also an impassioned piece of propaganda written for a particular historical moment, an essay designed to rouse Americans out of what Luce considered their slothful indifference and inspire them to undertake a great mission on behalf of what he considered the nation's core values. Remember that this essay came out almost 2 years before America entered World War II. It was an effort to force his fellow citizens to confront the reality of the war and America's obligations to play a forceful role, both in ending it and in building a better world in its aftermath. An effort to persuade them of the importance of saving Great Britain and defeating fascism. And as part of that effort, he sketched a bold picture of America's destiny that exaggerated only slightly what would, by the late 1940s, be a widely shared and increasingly powerful view, a vision in which American abundance and American idealism seamlessly merged. The American century, Luce wrote, must be a sharing with all people of our Bill of Rights, our Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, our magnificent industrial products, our technical skills. We have that indefinable, unmistakable sign of leadership, prestige. And unlike the prestige of Rome or Genghis Khan or 19th century England, American prestige throughout the world is the result of faith in the good intentions as well as in the ultimate intelligence and strength of the whole of the American people. Now, how, Luce wondered, could a nation that embodied such important and potentially universal values, a nation with such unparalleled wealth and power, how could such a nation remain on the sidelines in this great battle for the future of the world? All America's hope for the future, he insisted, would fail unless, as he said, our vision of America as a world power includes a passionate devotion to great American ideals, a love of freedom, a feeling for the equality of opportunity, a tradition of self-reliance and independence, and also of cooperation. We are the inheritors of all the great principles of Western civilization. Above all, justice, the love of truth, the ideal of charity. It now becomes our time to be the powerhouse from which these ideals spread throughout the world and do their mysterious work of lifting the life of mankind from the level of the beasts to what the psalmist called a little lower than the angels. Something of this same moralistic, evangelistic language appeared in another powerful call for a new American role in the world, a speech delivered a little over a year later on May 8, 1942, by Vice President Henry A. Wallace, and widely known as the Century of the Common Man speech, although its actual title was The Price of Free World Victory. Wallace, as many of you know, would later become a controversial and even reviled figure for his leadership of dissenting leftists in the early years of the Cold War and his bitter criticism of what he considered America's excessive militarism and aggression, and not least for his perhaps unwitting alliance with communists in his 1948 third-party campaign for the presidency. But he gave this speech at a high watermark in his political career. He was a little over a year into his vice presidency. He had a reputation, soon to be shattered, as the second most important figure in government, as the assistant president, as Roosevelt's likely heir. His 1942 speech was not the work of the later embittered and ostracized Wallace. It was the work of a prominent mainstream Democrat and an important and influential figure in the Roosevelt administration who was attempting to rouse the public behind a war that the nation had only recently entered and that it was not clearly yet winning. Wallace was indirectly, implicitly critical of what he considered the imperialistic tone of Luce's 1941 essay, and he was careful to distance himself from any notion that the United States could unilaterally impose its values and institutions on the world. But he too presented a vision of the future that included a central role for the United States in both inspiring and shaping a new age of democracy. He said, "This is a fight between a slave world and a free world. Just as the United States in 1862 could not remain half slave and half free, so in 1942 the world must make its decision for a complete victory one way or the other." And naturally, Wallace expected what he called the freedom-loving people of the world, who were not Americans alone, but among whom Americans stood preeminent. He expected Americans to answer that question and to shape the post-war world. And the character of their answer, he said, was embodied in the four freedoms that Franklin Roosevelt had proclaimed in January 1941, freedoms that are at the very core of the revolution for which the United Nations, the term being used at the time, of course, for the wartime alliance between America and Britain and others, the very core of the revolution for which the United Nations have taken their stand. And just as Luce's vision of an American century included the idea of exporting Western industrial abundance to the world, so Wallace insisted that the peace must mean, in his words, a better standard of living for the common man, not merely in the United States and England, but also in India, Russia, China, Latin America, not merely in the United States, as the West, in the United Nations, but also in Germany and Italy and Japan. And Wallace added, "Some have spoken of the American century." This was an obvious effort to distance himself from Luce. "I say the century on which we are entering can and must be the century of the common man." In the years to come, as Wallace's own vision and political fortunes changed a great deal, he came increasingly to see his speech as a full-throated rejoinder to what he considered Luce's more imperialist vision. But at the time, both Wallace and Luce spoke quite kindly about each other's remarks and seemed to agree that they were, on the whole, fighting the same battle. Wallace wrote to Luce shortly after Wallace delivered his own speech, "I do not happen to remember anything that you have written descriptive of your concepts of the American century of which I disapprove." And he said, it is almost precisely parallel to what I was trying to say in my talk. In his vision of a world modeled on American notions of freedom, in his commitment to spreading the fruits of economic growth to the world, in his insistence that older nations will have the privilege to help younger nations get started on the path to industrialization, in all of these ways, and also perhaps, most of all, in the extravagant rhetoric with which he presented these ideas, Wallace's speech was less an alternative to Luce's essay than a variation on it. "There are no half measures," he concluded. "No compromise with Satan is possible. We shall fight for a complete peace and a complete victory. The people's revolution is on the march, and the devil and all his angels cannot prevail against it. They cannot prevail, for on the side of the people is the Lord." The American century and the price of free world victory were both major documents of their time. Luce and Wallace arranged to have them repeatedly reprinted, and they circulated widely throughout the United States and through much of the rest of the world. But they are of interest today, not mainly because they had great influence on the public conversation of their time. Their influence, in fact, was probably relatively modest in the end. They are of interest, I think, because they are among the most visible symbols of a growing movement among American leaders, and eventually among many others, to redefine America's relationship to the world, and in the process, to redefine America's sense of itself. They make clear that the idea of an American century was not a product of the Cold War, that the idea preceded and helped to define the Cold War, just as the Cold War eventually helped to redefine it. And they suggest something of the crusading power that this idea came to assume among influential Americans across a large swath of the political and ideological spectrum. The idea of an American century found concrete expression in many ways. It helped support the aggressive internationalism of America's Cold War foreign policy after World War II and throughout the Cold War. It helped inspire the Marshall Plan and the larger post-war system of foreign aid. It helped sustain America's vast military establishment and justify the nation's increasing covert interventions in other nations. It helped bind the United States to the United Nations, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, and to legitimize the complex system of alliances that the United States created in the 1940s and beyond. But another compelling expression of that idea came in a series of efforts to refurbish and even redefine America's own idea of itself in the years after World War II. because in the aftermath of that terrible war, it no longer seemed possible simply to take for granted the moral and practical claims of democracy and freedom as Americans understood them. To many Americans, the great task after the war, a task that seemed even more urgent several years later as the Cold War cast its shadow across the cultural landscape of the United States, the more urgent task was to define American identity, to tie it firmly to a belief in the nation's great moral power, to mobilize the American people to embrace it, and then to export it to the world. This was the great cultural project of the 1940s and 1950s, a project fully compatible and often synonymous with the nation's geopolitical goals. And it mobilized in its service not just the state, but a large community of intellectuals, academics, writers, philanthropists, business and labor leaders, clergy, journalists, and many others. One of the earliest and most celebrated efforts to arouse popular enthusiasm for the idea of an American century, to reinforce American commitments to the particular virtues of the national project, was the Freedom Train, an exhibit of over 100 important documents and artifacts from American history, which traveled across the nation behind a red, white, and blue locomotive between 1947 and 1949. Among the items in the train's exhibit were the Mayflower Compact, the Bill of Rights, a manuscript copy of the Star-Spangled Banner, which had only recently become the national anthem, the Gettysburg Address, the Emancipation Proclamation, a draft of the Declaration of Independence edited by Jefferson, a copy of the Constitution annotated by Washington, one of Woodrow Wilson's drafts of the Covenant of the League of Nations, the flag that had flown at Iwo Jima, and much more. Upon leaving the train, visitors were invited to add their names to a freedom scroll and to take a pledge rededicating themselves to the American Creed. More than 3.5 million Americans visited the train during its two-year journey, and most of them, of course, signed the scroll. The Freedom Train represented not only the urgency behind the effort to promote American identity, but the vast array of forces committed to furthering this promotion. The idea emerged out of the federal government. William Koblenz, who worked in the Public Information Office of the Justice Department, proposed a traveling exhibition after being inspired by a lunchtime visit to the National Archives, the building next door to the Justice Department where he worked, where the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence are on display. He later wrote, "It seemed to me incredible that a display of such topical interest was not being brought to all the American people." And so he enlisted the support of the Attorney General and eventually of President Truman himself behind his idea. By allowing these great documents to travel across the nation, the Attorney General, Tom Clark, argued it might be possible to reverse the cynicism, disillusionment, and lawlessness that the end of the war had produced. And he said, "Indoctrination in democracy is the essential catalytic agent needed to blend our varying groups into one American family. Without it, we could not sustain the continuity of our way of life." Funding for the train came from major American banks and corporations, funneled through the so-called American Heritage Foundation, which was created to organize the train, and to remind people that freedom is a continuing struggle. The design of the exhibits was supervised by Hollywood studio executives. Its progress across the country was eagerly chronicled by the national press and published through an elaborate campaign designed and disseminated without charge by the advertising industry. The Freedom Train was one of many efforts by such private-public alliances to promote American values and cement the idea of an American century in the first years after the war. But the promotion of the American century was not simply a product of government and of defenders of free enterprise. It was a major project as well of the academic and intellectual worlds, and became most clearly visible in the growth of what became known as the American Studies movement. Before the war, there had been about a dozen programs called American Studies, scattered among a few elite northern colleges and universities, and mostly devoted to interdisciplinary work on history and literature, with no particular ideological foundation. After the war, both the number and the character of American Studies programs rapidly changed. By 1947, there were over 60 programs, spread through almost all regions of the country, and more than a dozen graduate programs, training scholars to keep the movement alive. And out of the American Studies movement, and also out of the formal American Studies programs, emerged a widespread scholarly ethos and an extraordinary outpouring of scholarship devoted to American national identity, to the idea of defining the American character and the nature of American democracy. Leo Marx, one of the pioneers of this movement, wrote many years later, in 1979, "Somewhere back of the American Studies idea, there once lurked an amorphous conception of the United States as the embodiment of a social ideal." Now, the American Studies scholarship was not uniformly or even primarily celebratory. In fact, some of it provided some extraordinarily harsh critiques of American culture and politics. But there was an essential unity within the movement in the belief that there was such a thing as a national character and identity, that it was important for the nation to examine and strengthen and improve its culture, and that there were lessons in this effort, both for Americans themselves and for much of the rest of the world. Many of the early founders of the American Studies movement became deeply involved in the Congress for Cultural Freedom, an organization of scholars and intellectuals funded, unbeknownst to some of them at the time, by the CIA, whose goal was to trumpet the superior virtues of American culture to a world tempted by communism. Others helped create the Fulbright program, which for more than half a century now has sent American scholars overseas to help other peoples understand the United States. And still others helped to create the Salzburg Seminar, a summer program in Europe, at which I once taught, I have to admit, conceived by three Harvard students in 1947, taught by leading American scholars of American studies, and specifically designed to help European students understand the United States and use its history and culture to rebuild their own. The Salzburg Seminar still survives, but not as an American Studies movement any longer. It's really as a kind of corporate retreat with a tiny, tiny fillip of American studies laced in it. In the beginning, however, the Salzburg Seminar was very much an effort to export American studies to Europe. Most of the faculty, led by F.O. Matheson of the American Civilization Program at Harvard, were people of the liberal left, determined to present a critical view of the United States and to illustrate its long and painful struggle for democracy. Hence Matheson's passionate belief that the central document of American studies was Herman Melville's Moby Dick. He wrote of it, "No more penetrating scrutiny has yet been made of the defects of individualism." Or Richard Hofstadter, who also participated in this, insisted that we Americans came with no intention of acting as national apologists. But they all also had, as Matheson told the first group of students who came from all over Europe, these are Matheson's words, a strong conviction of the value of American democracy and of its suitability for other societies. Heretofore, he said, Americans have come to Europe as students, But now we come, not to study your culture, but bringing our own. The Salzburg Seminar attracted funding from the Ford Foundation and from many other proselytizing American philanthropies and had the support of the American Department of State. In 1944, the British historian and great analyst of the United States, Dennis Brogan, published a book entitled The American Problem, which was later published in the United States under the title The American Character. He knew his audience. In it, he wrote of the challenges of facing the United States after the war in dealing with a world destined to become more and more interconnected. The American problem, he wrote, was a double one. The problem of making intelligible to the American people the nature of the changes in the modern world which they can lead or which they can resist, but which they cannot ignore. That is a problem for Americans. There is the second problem, the problem of making intelligible the normal American's view of the world, of his own history and destiny. Americans, he concluded, have much to give, materially and spiritually, a well-founded optimism about their own possibilities, a well-founded belief that some of the problems of unity have been solved in the American experience. The American Studies movement embraced these challenges and in times expressed the faith that Brogan described. And so, unsurprisingly, did Henry Luce, who had helped popularize the idea of an American century in 1941 and devoted much of his post-war energy to making his magazines effective champions of that idea, both at home and abroad, both in promoting the aims of American foreign policy and in leading a highly public search to define what he liked to call the national purpose. To Matheson and many other academics and intellectuals, the Luce publications were crude purveyors of a simplistic, hegemonic vision of the American century, although that did not prevent many of them from writing for Luce's publications, which paid extremely well. But in fact, Luce's magazines were far from uniformly celebratory, and Luce himself sought constantly to persuade leading intellectuals, including, as I've said, some of his most dyspeptically critical readers, to contribute essays to Life and Fortune. But Luce's magazines did indeed include a large dose of exuberant nationalism, particularly in the overseas editions that were becoming an increasingly important and influential part of his company's activities. Luce believed that by illustrating the brilliance and variety of American culture, business, religion, and politics, that his publications could help arouse Americans to commit themselves to the larger purposes he believed they must accept in the world, and also could help inspire the peoples of other countries to recognize the values of the American model. Most of all, his magazines could inspire the world to emulate the core values of the American people. The post-war time, Luce once explained to his editors, will have to do plenty of explaining to the new readers it hoped and expected to attract around the globe. It would have to explain itself, certainly, but it would also, as Luce put it, have to explain about America. This is the sort of homespun rhetoric that Luce at times liked to use, explain about. There was much about America that needed explaining to the world, Luce said, and not all of it was attractive. But, he said, if we had to choose one word out of the whole vocabulary of human experience to associate with America, surely it would not be hard to choose that word. For surely the word is, this will be no surprise, I'm sure, to you, freedom. Without freedom, America is untranslatable. And that, then, was the post-war mission of his magazines, and he believed of the nation as well. He wrote, Despite all confusions by which we have been confused and may have confused others, I think we have achieved some intellectual right to say that we of Time Incorporated, this is another characteristic of Luce, to refer to Time Incorporated as if it were a nation state, that we of Time Incorporated have fought, are fighting, and will fight for the freedom of all peoples. We believe that the relation of the people of the U.S. with the other peoples of the world must be based on the principles of freedom, and this can be endlessly celebrated. The idea of an American century and the widespread efforts to promote and solidify that idea reflected a vision of the nation that even in the 1940s, many Americans feared was unstable. How else can we explain the fevered efforts to promote and solidify that vision among a public that the very promoters suspected had a weak attachment to it? Even the proselytizers themselves offered very different versions of what America was and what an American century would mean. And yet, in the end, almost everyone involved in this great sprawling project seemed to agree that it was possible to define the meaning of America in terms that would be broadly acceptable, that there was such a thing as an American creed and an American character, that the idea of an American century rested on something more than a realistic appraisal of American power, that it had a basis in the values and culture of the American people. In the end, though, the American century theorists were never able to produce a definition of an American character or an American creed that adequately represented their own time, let alone ours. The Freedom Train is one of many examples of the great difficulties inherent in defining the American ethos. It was the product of awkward and difficult compromises that belied its message of a universal American commitment to a set of national symbols. There was a vigorous debate among the organizers over whether to include the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, known as the Magna Carta of Labor, as one of the central documents of American freedom, a debate that the defenders of including the act lost. Even the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution, guaranteeing African Americans equal protection of the laws and the right to vote, was, the organizers feared, too controversial to add to the train's picture of an American creed. There was a prolonged struggle over how the train should deal with the racial norms in the South and elsewhere, and a quite bitter debate among the organizers about the appropriate stance to take towards segregation. Ultimately, the organizers forbade segregated viewing of the train and canceled visits to several cities, including Memphis, Tennessee, and Birmingham, Alabama, that balked at that requirement. But they also made concessions to segregationists. In some cities, they permitted separate lines for black and white visitors and admitted them in alternating groups of 25 so they would never have to be in contact with one another. They permitted an extra car containing the Confederate Constitution to accompany the train through Georgia. Despite the huge popular interest that the Freedom Train provoked, the admittedly scanty evidence that we have suggests that very few African Americans, and indeed few people of color of any kind, visited it, perhaps a reflection of their view that freedom, for them and for many other Americans, continued to remain an empty ideal. Paul Robeson, the great actor and singer and activist, said at the time, "I want freedom itself, not a freedom train." Those who announced the dawn of the American century and the much larger group of people who attempted to promote it as a projection of American values and morality into what they saw as a crippled and beckoning world were able to sustain their image of a vital American creed only with considerable difficulty and only by ignoring, suppressing, or marginalizing the considerable conflict and diversity and injustice that lay just beneath the bright, shining surface of American life. Only by flattening out their vision of America and the world, and by creating a Manichaean vision of the globe. Their enthusiasm was understandable. They were acting in the shadow of the greatest war in human history that produced some of the greatest crimes against humanity that the world has ever seen. And they were acting, too, in the early years of a new conflict, more difficult to understand, sometimes vague in its aims, subject to no easily foreseeable revolution, but one that they considered equally momentous and that they believed required a firm commitment from the American people and from the nation's allies, a commitment that they knew would not be easy to sustain. Similar efforts followed the events of September 2001, as leaders from many areas of American life mobilized themselves to fortify and inspire the nation for a new and difficult struggle against a shadowy and elusive foe. The example of the comparable efforts of a half century ago, therefore, can be seen in our time, both as perhaps an inspiration, but also certainly as a warning. Because in embracing the idea of an American century in the 1940s, a generation of internationalists determined to overcome the nation's long tradition of isolation and autonomy in the world were in fact inventing a national image that they believed would be helpful to that goal, sometimes wittingly, sometimes not. And in creating this carefully constructed artifice and projecting it so energetically into the world, they were not only contributing to the creation of the kind of American century that so many predicted, a century in which they hoped America would be not just all-powerful, but also widely emulated and admired. They were also sustaining the nation's insular self-regard and isolation, which their project was allegedly designed to destroy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Alan, for an extremely well-crafted and absolutely fascinating lecture. We'll do a rather brief Q&A session. I wanted to start by asking you a question that really connects up very firmly to your conclusion. Now, your great colleague at Columbia, Eric Foner, has written a history of American freedom where he really shows the complexities of the concepts of freedom in American history as it developed out of the late 18th and 19th centuries. You stressed in your conclusion today on the mobilizing aspects of freedom as a rallying cry, both during the Second World War and maybe particularly in the early part of the Cold War. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit further on that, both with regard to Henry Luce and his private campaign, if one could put it that way, in order to make America more conscious of the world around it, but also in terms of official American policy during the Roosevelt administration and the Truman administration. To what extent was the concept of freedom, the limiting in many ways of the complexities of the American concept of freedom, a deliberate rallying cry for a further American involvement in the world, an involvement in which many Americans traditionally would have been rather skeptical participants?
So I can be seen by people on the other side of the room. Well, that's a very big and difficult question, but I'll try to make a few brief responses to it. The idea of freedom, which, as you say, my colleague Eric Foner has written about at great and very very perceptive length, has been a constant idea in American history, and it's taken many different forms and had many different definitions. And all you have to think about is things like the freedom struggle of African Americans, to understand how complicated this process is and how different it is from the idea of freedom that, you know, a century earlier motivated the American Civil War and the secession of the South. The freedom to sustain slavery was a very important part of American freedom in the 19th century. In the 1940s, freedom, as defined by Lewis and by many others of the people that I was describing in this lecture, who did not constitute, of course, the whole of American life or the whole of American intellectual life, and whose definition of freedom was not the only definition of freedom alive even then, that definition of freedom was rooted on a number of things, rooted in a number of things. Usually unstated, but also always central to these more public and official definitions of freedom, is the idea of free enterprise and the capitalist system. That is for most, although not all Americans, that has almost always been a fundamental part of our definition of what freedom means. It also means the autonomy of the individual, the freedom of an individual to live his or her life, although, of course, in the 1940s, people would have said to live his life as he pleases, and a kind of freedom from coercion, a freedom from the coercion of the individual. But it did not include a lot of things that other articulators of the idea of freedom, even in those periods, would have included. The idea of equality of opportunity, the idea of equality of condition were not parts, really, of this idea. The idea that women or African Americans or other minorities were unfairly oppressed was not part of this idea, except among a relatively small number of people. The idea that freedom means, in fact, a genuine commitment to freedom of public speech was not always a part of this idea, because, in fact, during the Cold War, there was a great deal of speech, obviously a very apt subject at this time. There was a great deal of speech that was thought not to be acceptable in the public sphere, or even in private. An enormous wave of self-censorship among Americans during the Cold War, as there is today, on certain subjects, because of the fear of government and popular retribution. So the idea of freedom that Luce was describing, that Henry Wallace was describing, at least in 1942, that most of the people that I referred to today were describing in the 1940s, was a very particular and fairly narrowly bounded idea of freedom that whose elements were probably shared by most Americans, but which left out a great deal of the content of the concept of freedom that were important to many other people.
Yes,
other questions?
I was very struck by the numerous references in the first part of your talk, both when talking about the 19th century roots of the phenomenon you were charting and indeed right up to Henry Wallace, of the extraordinary prevalence and sort of noteworthiness of religiosity and religious imagery in the rhetoric. It then rather disappeared from the radar screen. Did this reflect a genuine change? In other words, that religion became less important in the sort of latter half of your paper chronologically? Or was it just a coincidental change in emphasis in your talk? So did religion remain at the heart of the project, or did it become less important after World War II?
Well, as I sense you already know, America never becomes less important in America. And the rhetoric of religion was a particularly powerful temptation during the war itself. During the war itself, there was a very religious mode of presenting the goals of the United States by national leaders as well as by religious figures. After the war, one reason that the tone sort of leached out of my talk after the war is that I was talking mostly at that point about academics and intellectuals and others for whom religiosity is not usually so important. But after the war, at least for a time, the rhetoric of religion became less visible in public speech, although the reality of religion and the power of religiosity within American society did not. I think it's very clear that whatever inhibitions public officials had in the 1940s about talking about religion have if not vanished, at least weakened in recent years. But America is an extraordinarily religious nation, even though it also has a very large and very militantly secular minority. And so ideas about freedom have always been tied in some way or another by many Americans to religion. Henry Luce, who was the son of a missionary and himself a very devout Christian, never doubted that freedom was an important part, that American freedom in particular was an important part of Christianity. And he was, not in the American Century essay, but in most of his public statements, he was relatively reluctant to speak about religion openly. But he certainly believed it.
President Sennett?
I'd just like to pick up the end of your lecture, a very provocative critique of what you have described. And I wonder if it doesn't connect to where American behavior in the world is today, which is it helps us to understand a kind of indifference to those whom America has in its power as separate cultures, separate religions, and so on. That the kind of anxiety about finding what America is a way of losing curiosity, in a way, about the actual effects that American power has on those who differ.
Well, a more cynical person than I might argue that all of this rhetoric from the 1940s to 2006 about democracy and freedom and America's spreading the gospel to the world is simply window dressing for securing America's interests in the world in whatever way it finds it necessary to do so. I don't believe that that's always been true. I could be convinced that it's true today. But in any case, there certainly always were real interests and hard-headed people who identified those interests and sought ways to pursue them, who made use of this superstructure of ideology that was created, sincerely or not, by many people of positions of leadership in the United States. I think whether or not we accept the cynical view or the more credulous view of the sincerity of this idea of an American century as a moral project, it did help people overlook the realities of what America's role in the world actually meant. The coups, the invasions, the covert activities, the bullying of allies, all of the things that we know, of course, were central to America's behavior in the Cold War and have remained central to American behavior since. So I don't think we have to make a decision about whether this rhetoric was sincere or cynical to understand how it helped the realpolitik project of the United States at the same time.
Mick Cox, the other director of the Cold War. This is a very brief question, Alan. We know when the American century was announced, and we know why it gained the widespread appeal that it did. How will we know when the American century is over?
Probably when the oil runs out. I don't know how we'll know. I do believe that the American century, however long it turns out to be, is not eternal. And I don't believe that America will be the unchallenged great power in the world for very long. China, India, even Europe, all have the capacity to rival the United States in various ways. And it's only a matter of time until one of them does.
Yes, please.
Can I tackle you on the phenomenon of the born-again Christian? The term seems to have mutated in its quite short life to a quite extreme and conditional mindset. Is it a sort of political vehicle now? And when were the roots of the born-again Christian? Was it in the last century, the evangelicals?
Oh, no. The roots of born-again Christianity, you know, go back to Calvinism and to Puritanism in England. I mean, the idea of being born again in Christ, first of all, that's a fundamental doctrine of Christianity for all Christians, that you're born again in Christ at baptism. But the idea of being born again through a direct and personal relationship with Jesus or the Holy Spirit, that you've somehow been touched by God and born again sometime in the midst of your life, as opposed to at the beginning of your life, is what we normally now refer to as born-again Christianity. And this was a fundamental belief of most of the early settlers of the United States, as well as many people in Britain and in the Netherlands and the Low Countries, Protestant Christians almost all over the world. It continued through the Great Awakenings of the 18th century and the 19th century, and is very much alive today. So this is nothing new in American life. Now, what are the political implications of born-again Christianity, as I think with the beginning of your question? And there are many different implications of this. People who believe themselves to be born-again Christians are not always people of the cultural or political right. They don't always represent the views that we hear so often from people like Pat Robertson and others. Jimmy Carter, our former president, who claimed to be a born-again Christian, although it was never clear whether he meant that in the inspirational way or in the sort of standard way of Christian baptism. But he allowed himself certainly to be portrayed as a born-again Christian, but he represented a breed of Christianity, as did members of his family who were very open in having been born again in the way, the modern way that we understand that term, who were actually very committed to social improvement, social gospel. And in fact, the social gospel movement of the early part of the 20th century was driven in part by people whose Christian faith had been activated by what they believed was direct communication with the Holy Ghost or with Jesus. So this can work in various ways, but I think if you look at America today and at the very large evangelical community of the United States today, it is more often the case that evangelical Christianity produces a kind of conservative cultural politics than not.
Let's see. We got one question down there. I'll actually do two or three questions now, and then ask Alan just to sum up in conclusion. Please.
You said towards the end of your lecture that America should be not only powerful but also respected. Now, you also quoted people who paraphrased the American century as the century of the common man, or as a way of projecting the values of the American nation. Now, with this in mind, I would like to ask you, do you think that President Bush is a good example of the common man, or he is a good personification of the core values of the American nation?
Yeah, I'm sorry, could you repeat the last part of that? A good example of?
Of the core values American nation.
Okay, we've got one down here.
Yes, I'm also struck by some American friends who are extremely hostile to the idea of multiculturalism, which was so in vogue in the 1990s. On the other hand, multiculturalism seems to be an extension of an idea of freedom, the freedom to be different. How has this traditional American idea of freedom reacted intellectually to this challenge?
Let me have last question over there.
Yeah, very quickly to just follow up one of the previous questions. It seems to me that from your talk, if I understood it right, then the American century could never be really over. If it is so centrally rooted in American identity, then it is something, it's a project that can never really end.
All right.
Well, those are very good questions, and I'll try to answer them briefly. Is Bush a representative of the common man, and is Bush a representative of the core values of the American people? I think Bush is viewed by many Americans as being a representative of the common man, and his roots in Texas, seeming love of NASCAR racing, the way he talks in other ways, seems to many people to be a very common and approachable person. In fact, he is about as far from being a common man as one could imagine. He's the son of a president, the grandson of a senator. He went to Yale. He went to Harvard Business School. He's wealthy. He was helped through life by powerful friends at every step of his career. No one could have had a less common life, or few people anyway, than George Bush. So there is an image of him that is widely believed as being a common man, but the reality, I think, is quite different. Does he represent the core values of the American people? Well, I think he represents the values of many American people, at least about half of the population, but certainly not all. And of course, different people identify with Bush through different sets of values, and not everybody who supports Bush supports everything that he seems to stand for. The second question is about multiculturalism and how does that connect to or compete with the kind of notions of freedom that I've been describing. Well, the fact is that multiculturalism is a great challenge to the ideas of freedom that were being articulated after World War II, and that presupposed an essential unity among the American people about certain values. Multiculturalism is both a movement and a description of American life. And as that description became more fully understood, it became very clear, in fact, that there are very few values that are universally shared within the United States, and that they're very different views of America and the world among different groups of the population. And so there is a conflict, I think, as you suggested, between multiculturalism, the idea of multiculturalism, and the reality of it, and the idea of freedom that I described to some degree in this lecture. And then the last question was, how can the American century ever be over if the idea of an American century is so embedded in American life? Well, I suppose if you take my definition of an American century, which is an idea embedded in the American people, it could last a very long time. Just as Britannia ruling the waves probably survives in some part of the British people without necessarily reflecting a reality any longer. So I think you're probably right that the idea of an American century will survive the end of the American century in actual terms. Forever, I don't know, but it probably for some time.
The lecture tonight is a good example of what we're trying to do at the Cold War Studies Center. That is to put ideas under debate. So we try to look at different concepts of the issues that we are trying to put before you. In this case, the idea of an American century, which is not just, of course, one idea. It's many ideas. Just as we discovered during this lecture series, there are many Americans, many views of America, often best presented by people coming from the United States themselves. Next week, we are going to look at the American Empire, though, from the outside. Reminds me of this, what we're going to do next week reminds me of this story about the historian on his first date, when he said, oh, I've spoken enough about my book. Why don't you speak about my book for once? Next week, we will be dealing with a book that I just published, on the global Cold War and its implications for the present. Fred Halliday and Richard Immerman will be commenting. That's in the Old Theater next week at this time. To thank Professor Alan Brinkley for his wonderful lecture tonight, and all of you for attending. Thank you very much.